Oh, good afternoon, everybody. I've had the privilege and pleasure of knowing Gillian Court for a quarter of a century, and she's had a very varied and interesting career, which has taken her, for example, into church publishing, to South Africa in the days of apartheid, to organizing missionary work for USPG. She finally moved to Churches Together in Britain and Ireland as executive secretary of their department for enabling students to come from churches abroad to study over here, putting together funding for them and hospitality, working with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and the British Council, and ensuring information flow, as they say nowadays, between church and government. In the 1980s, she started serious work on Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life and thought, interviewing former students who had survived the Nazis, as well as investigating primary sources in Germany and elsewhere. She was indeed, for a long time, editor of the Anglican Lutheran newsletter. So her experience and knowledge is very wide. Her work eventually led to a thesis, a research thesis at Birmingham University, and that has been adapted into a book under the title Heart of Flesh, some copies of which will be available for purchase at the bookstall in the lunch hall afterwards. We are very fortunate, Gillian, that you've been able to come and talk to us today about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Prophet for Our Time. Gillian Court.
Good afternoon, Joss, isn't it? I have a slight hearing problem myself, so I understand what it's like if people can't hear. If any of you can't hear me, can you just kind of indicate in some way, and I'll try and do something about that. Dietrich Bonhoeffer is well known as a Christian martyr. My aim is to give you a glimpse in as short a time as I can into his prophetic role. I'll begin by setting the scene with some background, general background, and then move on to one or two particular questions, well, a few particular questions. Bonhoeffer was born in 1906 with a twin sister. They were the sixth and seventh children of eight children. Their father was professor of neurology and psychiatry at Berlin University. Their mother was of aristocratic descent. Dietrich was a university lecturer and a very gifted pianist. He was ordained in the Protestant Church in Germany. He studied in New York and worked as a pastor in Spain, Berlin, and London. He was active in meetings of the Ecumenical Council, the body that later became the World Council of Churches. In 1940, he moved into a group of influential Germans who were planning the assassination of Hitler and the overthrow of the Nazi regime. The historical background to the rise of National Socialism is complex. Its immediate trigger was the Great War of 1914-18. That war shook European consciousness, social structures, and economies. Due to the terms set up at the armistice, Germany suffered especially harsh effects. Psychologically, Germans felt humiliated by being held solely responsible for that war. The German economy struggled. Bonhoeffer vividly describes the appalling social conditions and widespread hopelessness he saw as a boy. Political extremists sprawled in German streets. The economy began to recover, but it was then badly affected by the Great Depression of the 1930s. By 1932, the fragile post-war liberal democratic government had effectively collapsed. Hitler harnessed a depressed spirit in the country with the promise of a new spring. He believed he had a destiny as the leader of a superior Aryan race, willed by Providence to rule the world. He combined a spiritual ideology of a type with a program for the reconstruction of the country. Nazism was a ruthless pursuit of power. However, outside Germany, as well as inside Germany, its essentially sinister nature was difficult to discern until it was too late. True prophets read the signs of the times accurately. By the time Hitler seized the post of Chancellor of Germany, Bonhoeffer was in no doubt that he would lead Germany into a vortex of destructiveness. The picture he paints is reminiscent of Ezekiel's image of the nation as a vine that produced leadership reaching to the clouds and was destroyed. He foresaw then that a time of martyrdom could be coming. International travel played an important role in Bonhoeffer's life because it took him out of the introspective isolationist mood in Germany. When he returned home from a year's study in America in 1931, he was very disturbed by the atmosphere of growing nationalism. And there is a strong sense in one of his sermons that at about that time, he had a fiery struggle with God. What he says directly about the experience is that the Bible, and especially the Sermon on the Mount, changed him from being an ambitious theologian to a true servant of Jesus Christ. Pacifism became obvious to him. He looked to the Hebrew prophets and the Psalms, as well as to Jesus, for inspiration. The message of the Hebrew prophets is that God longs for the people to know shalom, true community and peace, through their trust in God's faithfulness to them. They condemned false prophets and the abuse of power by state and by religious leaders. They warned against seduction by idols whose promises are empty. They spoke with passion and with urgency. They proclaimed God's anger and called for repentance. Nevertheless, they were convinced that God's love for the people was enduring. Therefore, they could speak with hope for the future. The presence of God in Jesus is characterized by a hidden authority that speaks to those who long for shalom, but which is a shock to established leadership that wants to exploit power. We find all of this reflected in Dietrich Bonhoeffer. For a scholar of his caliber, there is astonishing passion in his sermons and speeches. Right, the first matter I want to address is the discernment of the spirits or powers and principalities that dictate history. How often do we hear that mentioned? But in Nazi Germany, it was vital. Bonhoeffer spoke openly about demons and the demonic being in conflict with Christ. If we are not now comfortable with that language, then we need to find another with which to speak of the same truth. There is both light and darkness, good and evil in the world. They are active and robust, and involve us all. Bonhoeffer's criticism of life in the Protestant Church began well before Hitler became a serious contender in the political arena. His deepest fear was that it had become too shallow to withstand the onslaught of Nazism. He was right. Hitler came to power early in 1933. By the end of that year, Nazi agitators had forced the national bishop to resign, and a Nazi supporter was elected in his place. Jews were excluded from holding office in the church, and it was not long before the National Synod sought to impose an oath of loyalty to Hitler on pastors. The oath began, "I swear before God that I will be true and obedient to the Führer of the German people and state, Adolf Hitler." Reaction to National Socialism in the Protestant Church was divided. Some fully adopted the idea that Hitler was bringing about a reawakening of the church as well as the state. They were known as German Christians. Others tried to keep a distance between church life and politics. A third group, in which Bonhoeffer was an outspoken leader, actively opposed Nazi intrusion into the church's life and belief. In 1934, they declared a schism and formed the Confessing Church. The Confessing Church soon became illegal. Hundreds of its pastors were arrested. One that I met was buried alive in a concentration camp. Remarkable man to have survived without bitterness. In 1937, the Gestapo closed the Confessing Church training colleges. The following year, it issued a confession of guilt on behalf of the German people and asked congregations to pray for war to be averted. In response, the SS press made, quote, "the eradication of these criminals the duty of the state," end quote. Some Confessing Church members amazingly maintained their stand throughout the Nazi period, but overall it was silenced. Bonhoeffer's immediate objection to developments in the National Church was that the church ceases to be the church when it excludes people on racial grounds. He worked tirelessly to counteract the pressures brought to bear on the Confessing Church, particularly the pressure to take the oath of obedience to Hitler. He also worked very hard in meetings of the Ecumenical Council to make the world church aware of the true nature of National Socialism. His main ally in this was George Bell, the Bishop of Chichester, who is the subject of next week's talk. Bonhoeffer told members of the council very clearly that the light, capital L, was being extinguished in Germany and that they had faced an urgent choice between National Socialism and Christ. He partly achieved his objective, but the council too faltered at the critical point of discernment. It condemned the Aryan racial laws but allowed the Nazi-controlled National Church to remain in membership. Okay. Community and peace. Bonhoeffer was ahead of his colleagues in seeing that a church split was imperative. Confused and lonely, he accepted an appointment as pastor to two German-speaking congregations in London. While here, he maintained his opposition to German Christian leadership, continued his ecumenical work, and searched for a style of authentic Christian community living. He visited Anglican religious communities, a Methodist missionary college, and the Quaker College at Surly Oak. He also arranged to spend time with Mahatma Gandhi to study Gandhi's method of non-violent resistance. In the event, he could not go to India because the Confessing Church recalled him to be director of one of its training colleges. The students in the college had already received a theological education and were preparing for ministry in Confessing Church parishes. Bonhoeffer introduced a discipline of prayer, meditation, Bible study and social action that was quite unfamiliar to them. He would not have Jesus put into a dogmatic straitjacket or taken apart by speculation. Christ lives on, he said, in those who believe him, and to find his spirit we must be quiet and listen to what Jesus' life, words, action and suffering mean to us now. The question is not what we ought to believe, but who is Christ for us today? Bonhoeffer saw from the beginning that Hitler intended war. He spoke passionately about peace and the ties that bind people together across the world. He looked to the Ecumenical Council for an authoritative common voice that proclaimed peace in Christ's name. He argued that the ways in which the West has sought to guarantee peace by political treaties, stockpiling arms, and, note, through international capital investment in the big banks, are selfish and bound to fail because they are based in mistrust. And it is the mistrust that leads to civil conflict and war. He pleaded for the truth and justice that are an essential basis for peace and for the church to make its witness to peace through suffering. The church and the state. Everyone was sacrificed to Hitler's hollow promise. The aggression and extermination programs were one side of its face. The other was the brutalization of spirit that allowed them to happen. The wholesale destruction of life by the state appalled Bonhoeffer. It was axiomatic to him that the church lives not for itself, but for others, as Jesus lived in service for others. Bonhoeffer expected the church, as the minimum requirement of its belief, to speak up for the persecuted and those in need. He considered it blasphemy to worship God while ignoring their cries. The parables of the Good Samaritan in Luke 10 and of the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25 reveal those truths. On the night of the 9th of November 1938, the synagogues in Germany were burned down. A Dutchman, who later became General Secretary of the Ecumenical Council, was there at the time. He describes it as an explosion of inhuman, anti-human, and demonic forces. The Confessing Church, by then much weakened, remained silent. Bonhoeffer wrote the date in his Bible at Psalm 74, verse 8 to 9. They said to themselves, "Let us crush them with one stroke." They burn down every sacred shrine in the land. We see no more signs, no prophet anymore, and none of us knows how long it will last. Bonhoeffer was personally silenced. His license to teach at university was withdrawn. It was intolerable to him to fight in Hitler's armies or to take the required oath of obedience to Hitler. When he was called up, he arranged a year's leave in America, but returned home within a month, convinced he'd made a mistake leaving his people at that time. He resumed such training work for the Confessing Church as was possible. He applied to be an army chaplain and was turned down. In 1940, he was banned from speaking in public on the ground that he was subverting the people and required to report regularly to the police. It was then he began seriously to consider the move into politics. Though it was contrary to the tradition of his own church to cross that boundary, it was consistent with his own belief. Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law, Hans von Donjani, was a judge. During the war, he was on the staff of the Abwehr, the German military intelligence. He was a key person in the plans to activate a coup d'etat. He told Bonhoeffer that the conspirators needed him for his contacts abroad. They were an important line of communication with influential people outside Germany after the fall of France. Bonhoeffer decided that, as a Christian, he could no longer afford the luxury of keeping out of the eye of the storm. For him, the subterfuge and the complicity in an assassination plot were a price to be paid in the cleansing of German guilt. The times were exceptional. He trusted his conscience to God. He met with a Roman Catholic network that was reporting to the Vatican and went to Switzerland and Norway to meet leading members of the Ecumenical Council. He met Bishop Bell in Sweden in 1942. His brief was to convey a message to the British government through the bishop, asking for stable peace terms if Hitler was removed. He also had the conspirators' permission to reveal their names, which he did, to the bishop. In April 1943, he and others were arrested when suspicions about the activities of the Abwehr were raised. After the abortive attempt on Hitler's life in 1944, details of the conspiracy were discovered. Bonhoeffer was hanged with other conspirators, condemned of treason at Flossenbürg concentration camp 2 weeks before it was liberated. He was just 39. Okay, suffering of God. In Jesus and in the Hebrew scriptures, God is both mysteriously transcendent and present amongst us. Bonhoeffer believed unflinchingly that authority in eternity, in history, in nature, over the powers and principalities belongs with God. However, he found triumphal talk about an almighty God inappropriate and inadequate. He countered the idea of a remote, all-powerful and invisible God with the question, did not the cross become extraordinarily visible? The vulnerability and suffering of God in the world is central to Bonhoeffer's theology and spirituality. When Jesus struggled in Gethsemane, he asked his companions who fell asleep, could you not watch with me for 1 hour? In the circumstances, that question was alive for Bonhoeffer. It was in the sharing of God's suffering in the world that he found hope of freedom, blessing, and renewal. His deeply moving poem, Night Voices in Tegel, written in prison, reflects the role of the suffering servant in Isaiah 53. In his poem, the nightmare of prisoners' lives, his own fears, which he certainly had, and his thankfulness for blessings entwine in his trust of God. The impression he made on others in the midst of great danger was one of calm and cheerfulness. An Italian professor in prison with him said that his dignity, his goodness, and courageous kindness were a light in the darkness of prison life. He attributed that to Bonhoeffer's conviction that God, through Christ, would restore everything. The church in the future. When he was imprisoned, Bonhoeffer had first to concentrate on covering the conspirators' tracks in interrogation. Though nothing definite was proved against them then, there was no immediate prospect of release. So he returned to his thinking about the Christian community and its relationship with the world. The world, he said, has grown up, and it is pointless, even insulting, for the church to try to push it back into the thought forms and language of a bygone age. The prophetic message speaks of changing people's hearts rather than saving people's souls. The church, Bonhoeffer said, should stop trying to justify God, faith, and its own existence on the fringes where human knowledge runs out, for instance, in death and personal sin. It belongs at the centre of the life, helping the world to understand itself in the light of God's love. It should be in the public square, as we would say today, in the structures of society where the deepest impulses of justice, truth, and the good, or their opposites, are forged. Faith, he wrote, frees us to live in life's experiences and perplexities in the knowledge that God is with us. National Socialism begs so many questions for the churches that Bonhoeffer foresaw there would have to be a completely new beginning. He expected that in time, the purification of the church would give way to a new experience of Pentecost that would be as transforming as it had been for Jesus' followers after his death. He sought a church that walked humbly with its God, letting go of any privilege that it derives from its ties to the state. He thought it should give away its assets to those in need and learn to live truly as part of the world, because only then can it be free to be of service to others. It should practice a hidden or quiet discipline, gathering for worship, prayer, and just action while waiting for fresh word for God. And to end, just a couple of very brief comments. I am struck by how sensitive thinkers today are making similar prophetic critique of the powers and principalities. Professor Bob Goodsvaard, an economist and former member of the Dutch Parliament, said in a recent address to the churches on the crisis in the money markets, quote, "The deepest underlying cause of our present global crisis looks to me like the sudden betrayal of a self-made God. What our society most needs is the perspective of shalom combined with relief." He appealed to the churches to light the path. If people of good faith do not, who or what today is waiting in the wings to pick up power in the restless space? Few of us can doubt the degree of mistrust that characterises our own age, internationally and on our own doorsteps. The promise of shalom is the peace that comes from caring and sharing for each other and the future of God's earth. Shalom is to be found in the blessings of sufficiency, justice, and mercy, not in the hollow belly of the golden calf. It is in the values of the Sermon of the Mount, as Bonhoeffer discovered.
Well, Gillian, how can we thank you for that immensely impressive coverage of one of the most complex and far-seeing of Christian thinkers. And we do understand, as a result of what you've said, not only that Bonhoeffer was a genuine prophet, but also what prophecy means and the suffering that it brings to the prophet, him or herself. And that is in the Bible with Jeremiah and others, but we don't always think about it. So we are immensely grateful, and no doubt we shall next week hear more from the English end with Bishop Bell, and that will fill out the picture you have given us. So, very grateful indeed.